The title of my talk tonight is The Pursuit of Happiness, the Least Understood of Our Fundamental Rights. Nearly every American child of school age can recite that central line from our nation's Declaration of Independence. You can probably all recite it with me. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's the last of these three rights that I would like to focus on this evening. It's the least understood of the three. Now, in saying that the pursuit of happiness is the least understood of our fundamental rights, I don't mean to argue that we understand or appreciate or apply the other two perfectly. We don't. For example, the right to life seems like a given, so basic that no one would argue against its being extended to all. But every era in our nation's history, including our own, bears the stain of our governments not giving full legal recognition to the right to life of some. Because of their race, think of the slaves of the 18th and 19th centuries, or their health, the handicapped of the early 20th century, or their age, the unborn, and increasingly the elderly of today. The right to liberty, too, is basic, and is today the most celebrated of our fundamental rights. But what kind of liberty do we Americans claim for ourselves as inalienable? The freedom of the autonomous self, indifferent to all goods but self-expression? Or the freedom of the social animal that grows and deepens the more we virtuously pursue our particular and common goods together. I leave discussion of our misunderstanding of these rights aside in order to discuss our misunderstanding of our third fundamental right, the pursuit of happiness. This right is perhaps the most misunderstood popularly. What is happiness? And what does the pursuit And in what does the pursuit of happiness consist? No two people seem to agree. Nonetheless, while much of contemporary society remains at odds over the question of happiness, and while in some quarters this opposition runs very deep, even to the point of causing social stress, discussion of happiness is perhaps the easiest discussion of the three rights to undertake. The issues surrounding the question of happiness are among the simplest to clarify, aided as we are by centuries of religious and philosophical reflection on the issue. Still, our efforts today to discuss happiness are impeded on all sides. Even our nation's jurisprudence works against us. Thanks to a 1992 decision, it is now the considered opinion of the Supreme Court that, quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of life. That's an extraordinary statement. Our federal government no longer expects us, as citizens, to share definitions of the very things, even the most fundamental things, to which collectively we claim rights. This includes a shared understanding of happiness. Even so, our lives revolve around the question of happiness. Just last week, I received a text message on my phone. Happiness is a new iPhone. We all fixate on happiness. And advertisers at least assume that we all have the same thing in mind when we use the term. In my efforts this evening to clarify our understanding of the pursuit of happiness, I want to make only one point simply. It's this. The pursuit of happiness cannot have happiness itself as its goal. Instead, the pursuit of happiness must have some other kind of thing as its goal, some good that confers happiness when this good is possessed and enjoyed. In other words, if we want to pursue happiness, which is an effect of some action, we must look for and embrace the cause of happiness. Before examining what St. Thomas Aquinas has to say about the pursuit of happiness, I want to review briefly how social science today is rediscovering the ancient wisdom regarding happiness. That happiness is not itself something that can be pursued, but rather the result of the pursuit of something bigger than our happiness. Earlier this year, a student of philosophy and a student of positive psychology named Emily Esfahani Smith published a book called The Power of Meaning, Crafting a Life That Matters. And in this book, Smith provides a summary of recent happiness studies. Smith focuses on one study in particular, and it went like this. Researchers took a group of people and divided them into two sections. One section, they told, for the next month, pursue happiness. And the other group, they told, for the next month, pursue meaning. The first group, pursue what makes you happy. The second group, pursue what you find meaningful. And this is what they found. That after 1 month, those who pursued happiness reported to be less happy than those who pursued meaning. And what's more, they found that after 6 months, those who had pursued meaning reported to have maintained their sense of contentment and satisfaction much more than the other group. Their contentment, their satisfaction didn't diminish. So what were they doing, the people in the two groups? Well, those who pursued their happiness plunged immediately into the pursuit of sense pleasures. They immediately dove into seeking those kinds of things that made them, quote unquote, feel good. Extra sleep, less work, more leisure. Those activities that brought and bring immediate gratification. Easy pursuits. They did nothing, oftentimes, rather than something. They pursued all the creature comforts that we're told make us happy. Those in the other group that pursued meaning did not plunge into the pursuits of pleasure, but by and large, into service. They turned outward, away from themselves, to engage others, especially to care for the needs of others. The needs of their families, the needs of their friends, the needs of the sick, the poor, the lonely. They committed acts of sacrifice and delayed their own gratification in fulfilling the needs of others. They pursued all of the kinds of activities that we are told have meaning and give meaning to our lives. So for the researchers, their key finding was this. Those who engaged others before indulging in creature comforts reported to be more content, more satisfied, or were happier than those who indulged their creature comforts before engaging others. And what is more, those who pursued meaning, often they reported that they didn't like doing what they were doing, necessarily. It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't pleasing. It was hard. It required sacrifice and self-denial. But still, they registered greater feelings of happiness than those who sought happiness itself as their end. It's very interesting. Now, this study doesn't offer us, of course, the final word on happiness. Smith herself, in writing her book, knows this, and she encourages her audience not to read more into the study than is there. But she sees in the findings of this study an indication that the sources of real happiness are not what we popularly think of as happiness. Happiness is not typically found in the activities of pleasure that are turned ultimately towards the self. Happiness, however, is found, or seems to be found at least, in activities of meaning that are turned ultimately toward others. Smith herself characterizes these activities of meaning under four categories: belonging, purpose, storytelling, and the transcendent. Under belonging, we find those activities by which happiness is found in relating with others. Under purpose, we find activities of meaning wherein happiness is found in achieving the increasingly difficult personal, family, professional, or religious goals that we set for ourselves. Under storytelling, we engage in those activities of meaning in which we find happiness in discovering the meaning hidden in the key events of our lives. And under the transcendent, we find those activities of meaning by which we find happiness by placing ourselves in relation to the infinite. All very different than those activities by which we seek immediate satisfaction and the pleasing of the senses. Now, as a Christian believer and a Thomist thinker, I can't but help appreciate the findings here of this social experiment. Now, don't get me wrong, this isn't the language I would use to describe happiness, nor is it sufficient, I think, simply to report on the meaningful experiences of others. After all, according to this study and others like it, an ISIS fighter probably finds a lot of meaning in his life. He's purpose-driven, he finds meaning in group, and he seeks the transcendent. So how can we describe his pursuit of meaning as being any different from our own? So simple description isn't enough. To be sure, there are deficiencies in today's scientific descriptions of happiness. Nonetheless, they can be helpful insofar as they give us some empirical observation and confirmation of what philosophers for centuries have known about happiness. That to pursue happiness as an end is to destine oneself to miss the mark. In other words, happiness is not a goal, but rather the fruit of attaining a goal. The most important goals in life being set not by ourselves, but by nature. Because of the kind of being that we are, there are a set number of goals or goods, like food, shelter, clothing, reproduction, family, virtue, friendship, politics, religion, God, that perfect us and make us happy. Jesus himself had a way of describing the philosopher's distinction between happiness and the good, or what Smith calls the distinction between happiness and meaning. We find his description in Matthew 10:39. He who finds his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake will find it. And what remains of this talk, I want to examine St. Thomas Aquinas' discussion of happiness. Although St. Thomas often says that happiness is the end of life, and he says this throughout his writings, that can be deceptive. We have to pay close attention to what he's saying when he uses this phrase. Although he says often that happiness is the end of life, it is happiness which man seeks in every action. What he describes as the pursuit of happiness is actually the pursuit not of happiness itself, but of the goods that perfect our nature. In particular, the final good or end of all things that perfects every nature. And it's the possession of this good that makes us happy. Aquinas' treatise on happiness comes at the very beginning of what we call the Secunda Secundae, or the second part of his Summa Theologiae. The second part is the large middle section of the Summa, in which St. Thomas treats the moral life. In the first part, he treats God and creation. The second part, the moral life. The third part is Christ the sacraments, and the church. So it's in this middle part, when he deals with the moral life, and it's at the very beginning of that section, that St. Thomas deals with happiness and describes happiness. And that in itself is a remarkable thing, if you consider it for a moment. Because if I mentioned to you, or asked you the question, what's the first thing you think about, or what's the first thing that comes to mind when somebody might mention to you the church's teaching on morality? I mean, what would you say? Maybe I'll ask the question, what would you say? What's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word morality?
Fairness.
Fairness. So a certain quality, yeah, to be achieved.
Rules.
Rules. Yeah, that's a big one, especially if it's Catholic morality. Rules, law, obedience, conscience, those types of things. Aquinas doesn't begin there. He begins with the question of happiness. He begins with the end. What is it to be happy? And what makes us happy? For Aquinas, that's the question that morality answers. And that's the purpose of living a moral life. Not simply to be obedient, not to follow the rules. There's a deeper sense of this. It's to be happy. So what does he mean by that? Well, Aquinas, to describe happiness, human happiness, he asks five questions. And what I'd like to do is just go briefly through all five. First, he asks, does the human creature, the human person, have a final end? Now, what lies behind this notion is Aquinas' understanding that all of human action is driven by desire. Everything we do is driven by some need that manifests itself in us as a want and as a desire. All desire in us has its origin in some imperfection, which longs to be perfected, which longs to be satisfied. For example, I'm hungry and I want to eat. I'm ignorant. I want to know. I'm lonely. I want to love. In every action that we undertake, we seek to perfect some deficiency in us. And happiness is the result when some desire is satisfied. The longing is quenched. We rest in the good that we seek. That's the experience of happiness. Happiness is the resting that we enjoy in the lack of desire. I rest in the enjoyment of having a good meal and ending the desire for hunger. I rest in the enjoyment of new learning and the ending of my ignorance. I rest in the enjoyment of a new friend who satisfies my longing for companionship. In each of these situations, in each of these restings, in each of these quenchings of desire, I experience something of happiness. Now, when surveying all of the many goods that satisfy all of our many desires, Aquinas asks whether there is one good that satisfies every deficiency of our nature, every desire of our heart. And to this question, he answers, yes, there is one good, the source of all good, that satisfies all our wants, all our needs, all our longing. And therefore, there is one good that gives us complete satisfaction. And he says this one good is the same for all. So what is this good? And that's what St. Thomas asks in the second question. The second of his five questions. What is this good? Is it wealth? Is it honor? Is it fame or glory? Is it power? Is it some good of the body? Is it any pleasure? Is it any created good at all? And in answer to each of these questions, as he surveys all those things that we tend to plunge ourselves into when we seek happiness as our goal, Aquinas says, no, none of these things is that one good that satisfies our every need. Now, in pointing to all of these goods, wealth, honor, fame, power, goods of the body, pleasure, other created goods, his point is not to say that they're evil. They're not evil. But they are unable to serve as man's final end, that one good that quenches all desire. They satisfy some needs of nature, as food satisfies the need of hunger, as clothing satisfies the need for warmth, as a friend satisfies the need for companionship. All of these things provide us some happiness, but an imperfect happiness, because they don't satisfy the highest needs of our nature. None of these things can provide us perfect happiness. And so what are our highest needs? Well, Aquinas treats this topic in his third question. So question number three, what is man's highest need? Aquinas answers this: because the intellect is man's highest power, and because understanding is the intellect's highest act, then the understanding of the first and highest truth is that activity that will satisfy man's highest need and quench his highest desire. To know first truth, the source of all truth, and not just to know it, but to understand it, to pierce intellectually into the very essence of first truth, that quenches our highest desire. But just what is this intellectual activity? Is it the understanding of the practical sciences, which is to say the understanding of ethics or politics? Aquinas says no, although understanding those things is a good thing. Is it understanding of the speculative, what he calls the speculative sciences, like physics and metaphysics? Again, those things are good, but no, they don't satisfy our highest desire for knowledge. Is it the contemplation of the angels? Aquinas says, no, a nice thing to do, but we're not there yet. What about the contemplation of God? And here Aquinas says, we hit on the answer. The satisfaction of man's highest need as an intellectual creature, the quenching of man's highest desire, the desire to understand, is found in the intellectual vision of the divine essence, in which man is given to see God and to rest completely satisfied in that vision. In Aquinas' words, quote, for perfect happiness, the intellect needs to reach the very essence of the first cause, and thus it will have its perfection through union with God as with an object, in which alone man's happiness consists. So once Aquinas describes that activity, and once he identifies the good, the object possessed that leads us to our highest happiness, God, Aquinas moves on to his fourth question. How is it that we attain this vision of God? What's required for us to enjoy this vision? And here Aquinas explains that nothing created, not our body, not our soul, not our will, not our intellect, not other people, nothing, nothing created contributes anything substantial to the enjoyment of our final happiness. In other words, our final happiness does not depend on any of these things to contribute anything. The whole of our happiness, he says, is found in God alone, and in the graced vision of himself that he grants us by his mercy. Now, where there may be something of a natural desire in us to see God, actually to see him in himself is neither natural, it's not owed to us. To the contrary, it's completely given to us as a gift in which body, soul, intellect, and others will enjoy, but as gratuitous and as a complete mercy given us by God. And the fifth question, how do we attain this happiness? Well, to complete his description of happiness, Aquinas builds on the previous question and distinguishes between the natural pursuit of happiness in this life, which is found in our pursuit of the goods of nature, which again lead to this real happiness, but an imperfect happiness. He distinguishes between that and the supernatural pursuit of happiness in glory, in heaven, found in God, which isn't completely separate from this life, however, for its being supernatural. Even now, Aquinas understands, in the Christian life, we can begin to pursue the beatific, the beatifying vision of God through the life now of the infused virtues of faith, hope, and charity. The baptized Christian, or I should say, the gift of baptism, opens up to the human creature not only the possibility to look upon the face of God and to see him in his essence, but also destines the human creature to that gift, that reward, by allowing the human creature, even now, in this life, to pursue that vision through exercising the virtues of faith, hope, and charity. So that's Aquinas' discussion of happiness. That's how he begins his whole treatment of the moral life. He outlines the end, that which God places before us as the goal of human life, as the goal of our moral striving. Aquinas understands that God places himself before us, and the vision of himself, the vision of his essence, as that good that is the source, the object of our happiness. It's him that we pursue in order to be happy. Why? Not because God chooses it to be that way, but because of the kinds of creatures that God has made us to be, intellectual creatures, which because we can know universal truth and come to love the universal good, the one thing that will satisfy us ultimately, completely, and make us perfectly happy, is God himself. So of course, Aquinas, in these five questions, he simply scratches the surface of the question of happiness. There's much more to say. He does say more throughout his works. But what we've covered this evening, I think, is enough just to give us a basic description of the pursuit of happiness, at least according to ancient and Christian wisdom. Contrary to the popular understanding of happiness, its pursuit is found not in easy pleasures and in creature comforts, nor is it simply a matter of pursuing meaning. again, because of the kinds of creatures that we are, with minds capable of universal knowledge and of wills capable of loving the universal good, God alone, as the universally true and the universal good, stands before us as the object of our happiness. In Him alone do our minds and our appetites find complete rest, satisfied of every need, quenched of every desire. The happiness of the image of God that we are is found finally in being like God, which comes as the result of seeing. In the words of St. John, quote, "Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be." In other words, as God's children, we do not know yet how we will be finally happy. But, St. John continues, we know that when He appears, when Christ appears, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. Thank you.